This week on RSVNB Update, it's Battle of the Monolith Week 3, and we get help from an unexpected source, the Tokar. We unpack what their arrival means and what's truly going on with the Codex. RuneScape's new marketplace is live, and we discuss drip feeding. This is RSVNB Update, episode 833, recorded Thursday, June 10th, 2021, The Inner Behemoth. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of RSVNB Update. This week, we are headed into week three. A battle of the monolith, and you know it's been quite the week for you, hasn't it, Tanis?
Been a pretty long week.
I mean, in relation to the monolith, of course.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in all a good time. Joining us to talk about what is it can only be described as a ramp up in the way Battle of the Monolith is going is Clan Quester named One Rib, who you know you might think only has one rib, but is very, very wealthy, versed in RuneScape lore, has a Master Quest cape, and has put some rather interesting theories together on the Codex, otherwise known as the Monolith, and Erebus. So welcome aboard.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
We're going to have a discussion about that in just a little bit, but we're going to start off this show talking about what occurred in week three of Battle of the Monolith. If you want to join us in game, we are at Friends Chat, Bits Bytes. You can also, of course, find full show notes at update.rsbnb.com. And the Battle of the Monolith continues yet again this week. And this is where it, for me, it really started to feel like a mini quest this week. How did that feel to you, Rib, about that?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely feels a lot more like a mini quest. Because, like, the last few weeks, it was just, like, one battle. Like, we just stayed at the monolith and, like, this one battle. And for this, we actually branched out into the Tsar City and tried to recruit the Tokar. So, yeah.
Yeah. And this is, I think, where we start to really underscore all the things that are happening in Battle of the Monolith. Because as it stands and in the battle reports, you can see that, you know, we're just really holding out all hope, and there's a number of options you ask about who you could seek out for allies, the Avian Seas and Armadil. We learn that Armadil is on Tardiad. He said he was contemplating going there in Sliske's endgame. And then, of course, you could also ask the Zamorakians, and Elise basically says, hell no. But then when you, the character, suggests the Tokar, he says, I've never thought of that. And your character points out that those were the beings that helped the Elder Gods build Gelenor. So it was worth a try. And with that, you have to head on over to Tsar City and head to the kiln. And this is the kiln part, not the fight caves or fight pits. It's the kiln where you do all of the other capes. You get the kiln cape at the end of it. And were you shocked or surprised that this is where we were headed?
I'm really not. I feel like it's like pretty natural because the Tokars are involved in the Elder Gods, right? They have to bring in them at some point.
Yeah, they have a very, very, very tight link to that. Tanis, what was your thoughts when you got sent there? Because obviously we're not at the battle report yet where the true struggle was you, but...
I don't know. I feel like looking back, it must have been really self-explanatory, but I went to the wrong place. I went to the city square where you start all the other quests and talk to all those people. I'm like, what is going on? And then I finally was like, wait a minute. I went back to my bank. I grabbed that ring from way back in the day and just teleported to the kiln.
And
I'm still configuring. I'm like, well, yeah, you know what? I'm just going to go in. And if it starts to fight.
It is hard to find the kiln unless you teleport directly there. And when you go in, you are presented with the Battle of the Monolith option. And this is, you know, for me, where this entire thing took off like a rocket ship. But of course, just spoilers ahead, of course, because there's some lore in here that you might not want spoiled if you haven't done this yourself yet. But you have this discussion. You talk to Tuckar Hawk, who says that we need help, and he says, "You smell of anathema," which of course is shadow anima. Then you say creatures are coming through the shadow realm, they're coming through a portal, and we can't fight them off. The Tuckar just stares at you in silence, characters as well, and he says, "We're searching for what? The correct protocol. The masters will have told us what to do. The masters will have told us what to do."
So they knew about Shadow Anima.
Yeah, they did. And the masters to the Tuckar have to be the Elder Gods, right?
Right.
And following from that, everything's really just started to fall into place here for me. And what I... And this is wild theory time for me. My thought... Following from this is that with the help of the Tuckar coming to our aid in Battle of the Monolith, my theory is that our willingness to work with the Tsar, and in particular these beings, these tools that the Elder Gods use to shape the world, our willingness to work with them will help us when it comes to dealing with the Elder Gods. Because you remember, all this time, there was this talk of maybe Jazz can do something when we talked to Jazz in Azanadra's quest. And, or did we talk to Jazz in Azanadra's quest, or am I remembering that incorrectly? Or is that Desperate Measures we talked to
Jazz?
Measures.
Okay. Yeah, I think Desperate Measures.
Okay. Well, when we talked to Jazz last... She had said, or they said, that they would be watching us. And I think that if we can demonstrate our ability to work with these creatures that these Elder Gods hold in such high esteem, the Elder Gods might just have a solution for when and if their eggs hatch from the excess shadow anima that has been brought on to our Earth, or to Gielinor, rather, not Earth, Gielinor. And that's my theory of where this is going.
Interesting. I actually think, I don't think the Elder Gods, like, hold the Tuckar in much esteem. Like, I actually think, like, they still think, like, the Tuckar is kind of some kind of tool, right? So,
yeah.
Personally, I think, like, if they see this, they're like, okay, so you're using a hammer. I created it. So what?
So you're basically saying then that the Elder Gods see the Tuckar the same way they'd see one of their Elder artifacts then, except maybe even in a little bit lower regard then, just their tools then.
Not really a lower regard, but like about the same as, for example, the Stuff Jazz or...
Okay, sure. Fair enough. And that raises some interesting questions about the sentience of the Tsar, doesn't it? Because... they are sentient in the way that you talk to them, but have you ever heard of any other such elder artifact or elder tool be that sentient? So that's a really interesting discussion, and I have a feeling we'll be discussing more about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually.
Because, you know, they say, take this opportunity to train up to 75 slayers, 74 archaeology, and 74 magic.
You know, the needle had the guardian. It had a person... with it.
Yeah.
Ah, true.
That was communed with it for a while. Very true. And, I mean, the way I see it, there's nothing that can prevent a sentient being from intertwine with an elder artifact or an elder tool, as we're calling the Tsar with this one. So, I feel okay with that. You guys ready to dive into the cutscene from this week? And, you know, as per usual, these cutscenes are always so beautiful in the way that they're worked out, in terms of just how they look and what they're able to accomplish with this. And we're almost there. Just a couple more seconds, and here we go.
The invaders from beyond proved too much for the brave allies. Yet hope was not lost. Gilenor had defenders still. The Tok'har, the hounds who created this world, the servants of the elder gods themselves, stood with us. But the worst was still to come.
And as all the other ones have ended, the worst is still to come. Okay, so we got the big bit of lore out there, and now we head into the battle this week, the most difficult one yet. And, Tanis, I know these are difficult for you, and there's always this discussion going on that you're having about, is it you or is it the accessibility? And the reason for that is you got to defend this time the Eastern Gates of Varrok and the farm near the Gower farm, I guess you call it, where we have the Gower quest. Interesting, that's what's being attacked.
Yeah, I know, right? When I was playing, I was joking like, oh, the shadow creatures are so doomed now. They stand no chance against Brassica Prime.
Oh, that's so true. That's so true. Who knows? But I think we're beyond the stage of comic relief where Brassica could come in and deal with that. But this week, you got Hellweir. You got the Guthix wizard, whose name I can't pronounce. You got Nex, and you got Commander Zilyana. Plus three Tok'har. The four originals are stationed near the Guthix Memorial site where we had the Easter event this year. And the three Tok'har are stationed near the Varrok Gate. Now, recall that coming out of the monolith are a series of colored divination wisps that point the track that the baddies will take. And what I did this week is I stationed the three Tok'har at the northern pathway leading out of the Archaeology Guild. And I just put them there all clumped up. Imagine you come down the stairs of the Archaeology Guild and turn left. That's where I put that. Turn left if you're facing down the stairs of the guild, or as you're walking east, I guess I should say. And then I put everybody else, Hellweir, Commander Zilyana, Nex, and the Guthix wizard guy, who I can't pronounce, directly at the foot of the monolith. And this got it for me in two tries. And I didn't need to really do much aside from a little bit of micro at the end. I sent Commander Zilyana to clean up a few creatures that were that got through and were near the farm. And that was it. That's how I did it. And I realized describing it to you like this, Tanis, makes it sound a lot simpler than it came out to be, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, maybe it explains the continual failure, because how did you know that there were creatures that had gotten through? And if there's no one at that farm and they had gotten through.
There are messages in the chat box that show when the barriers are at 50% and 25%.
That sounds like that would be.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, they're so far away from the monolith. Like, by the time you get a message, if you start running now, like,
Oh, yeah. And these characters, you know, move slower than your own walk speed too. So you kind of, if you were doing it in that case and you had a bulk load of them there, you'd have to go there and do it yourself, which, you know, based on how many of them there are, that's probably not the best idea.
Yeah. I actually found this a little bit easier than last week somehow.
Oh, interesting.
So I didn't. Yeah.
Where did you put everyone?
I just put the three Tok'har at the Varrok Gate, like basically where they started. I moved them like a few squares.
Right.
And then
okay, so by the gate.
I put Howard at the foot of the monolith. And then there's an intersection where the for the, there are two paths towards the farm, right? There's an intersection where the two paths split off. And so I put Nax, the druid guy, and what's that again? Commander Ziliana at that intersection.
All right, and you got it in one go?
Yeah.
Yeah, and
a few of them slipped past and was attacking like the Southern Barrier Fort Farm, but like I had to like kill them myself. But otherwise, yeah. I think it's like slightly easier than last week for me, actually.
Yeah, and that makes me wonder what we're gonna have to do next week, because I feel asking to watch over two paths is already quite the ordeal.
Yeah, no, especially since they spread out so much, like it's so far between the two.
Yeah, and I mean, where are they going to go next? I don't know. So
when I was doing it, I was thinking maybe if, like, because Alcarid is just south of
the
farm,
could be another one as well.
And the Elder Hole is in the desert. So I was kind of thinking maybe they were going to the Alcarid.
Yeah, maybe push through the desert or something.
Yeah.
To that effect, because that is right there, as you mentioned. But in any case, I think, Tanis, you and I need to get together on the weekend, and just so I can see what you're doing and exactly what the issue is. Because I'd like to put together some form of constructive feedback on this based on what I see and based on what you see and feel the issue is on this. Because because I don't think it's fair that something that is designed to be lore-based is taking you hours to do. That's the thing.
Granted, I mean,
it's magnifier that you're using, but still, it should be easy to work through.
That's what I'm going back and forth with is because I can't use any accessibility features. That it just can't be done. I can't use magnifier because of the nature of magnification. You make one thing bigger, you lose something on the edges. And as One Rib just mentioned, this is all about being spaced out. And then that makes me go, okay, well, is that part of the challenge? Is that a mechanic? If so, like, I don't even know what to think, because like, you would think because I can't use the magnifier that, you know, maybe I would be able to get through it, you know, like normally, but I'm not doing that either. And then in that case, it's like, well, what's getting in the way? And the only thing I can come up with is just that it's the spacing and it's the visual clutter that is getting in the way for me or something.
Yeah, I mean, based on what you describe, because for anybody unaware, Tanis uses the magnifier normally when he plays RS. So as a result, a section about a third of the screen around his mouse is what's viewable. And if you need to be consistently moving your mouse and looking at different parts of the screen, that makes things a little bit difficult to do. But at the same time, maybe there's a way we can get through this. So I think it'd be good if you and I have a sit down some point over the weekend, and you know, you can show me your screen and we can see exactly what's going on.
Yeah, sure. Number one, I'm going to try One Rib's setup here.
Yeah.
See if that might help. It's good to know that there are two entrances to the farm. I suspected that, but I wasn't 100% sure. So,
yeah, one on each side, north and south.
Okay.
Yeah,
and I'm guessing either one of those could make you fail.
Yes.
But, all right, so that might be. here was like the biggest problem was like, if you like, I couldn't find those wisps at all, and until you said like they were there, I didn't believe they were there. And even after you said they were there, I kept looking and looking. I couldn't find them for the longest time. And then finally, you know, I had just kind of moved my eye around just the right spot, and I caught one. And once I caught one, I was able to kind of, you know, follow them.
Yeah. But they're purple, green, and red. I don't know how that works for your color blindness.
Yeah, I mean, not good. So, like I said, those wisps were kind of invisible for a while.
Right.
Until I kind of located one and then could just kind of follow that. But
all right, fair enough. Yeah. And once the battle completes, all Ali has to say this week is, you weren't wrong about the Tokar. Formidable creatures. With them here, we should get this mess cleaned up shortly before many more fall. And that's the end of the battle in-game this week. Of course, alongside this, we also have the battle report, September 18th. And I actually had an interesting realization about this after the show last week. And I think it was...
I had a realization today when I was... Okay. Yeah.
You want to go first or should I?
Go ahead, Shane.
All right. So we produce the nibbles, like, you know, like the short little bits of the podcast that we put up on YouTube to be quickly digestible. We like to think of them as a best part of the update, so to speak. And as a result of that, in producing those and putting them together, I thought that, okay, we go in game. We take part in this tower defense game. We get a little bit of lore from Ali and Trindine and the cutscene. And following from that, that's enough to move the story forward and to show what's happening, that there is this battle going on around the monolith. And we're working up towards something bigger because, you know, when we talked to Ali this week, he says that we need help, and you know, you effectively have to run through this list of people who could help, from, you know, the somewhat likely, potentially like Armadil, to the least likely like Zamorak, and then your player recommends the Tokar. And that revelation in itself and what the Tokar has to say is enough to set the scene of what's happening in the battle this week. But if you're a lore player, if you're a quester, if you're a member of Clan Quest, you want more from this update. And what a perfect way to bring that in, rather than these battle reports that are effectively narrative stories. So I thought, okay, so this is like a quest. What do most people do in quests? A good chunk of the population space bars through quests.
Uh-huh.
And doesn't read the lore. And doesn't take it in. So, you can't spacebar through this cutscene. You can play the battle, and you have to talk to Ali and Trindy to start this off. So, there's nothing you can skip in this. So, these battle reports are that little bit extra that all those lore players do when they're doing a quest. And this is what makes it for them. And this is Jagex delivering to them while trying this different format that caters nicely to people who like quick quests.
I mean, I agree, but I kind of don't like how it's being treated as an extra, like,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean, and we have a question about that later, about splitting up the update into multiple weeks and what that can do for us going forward, and I think that's a certainly valid discussion to have, but I think the lore aspect of this can't be understated, that you can get so deep in terms of the narrative we were presented with the battle reports.
Well, are you talking about that, though, One Rib, or are you talking about having it separated out of the game into another place? Because we talked about that last week, and that kind of goes to the revelation I had this week of, because I was very much on the side of, this should all be in-game, and it should be contained within the game world, you know, not necessarily on the website. But this week, after the frustration of the battle, and I was listening to the battle report, because I can actually, you know, since I use a voiceover on my phone,
you can have it read it to you.
I can have it read it to me. And that kind of changed my perspective quite a bit, because in game, I feel like there's only so much dialogue you can put in the little dialogue yep. boxes, and I can't, like, those are a nightmare to try to read.
Yep.
Anyway. And although I appreciate it being like in the game because of the immersion factor, it was so much, I felt like they could write it so much richer.
Yeah.
I really, really got yeah. into the story this week.
And that's what lore players want.
Yeah, I agree, honestly. Like, when I read this, I was like, if this is like just dialogue in game, it's just bad dialogue. But then my main problem with this is, why isn't the Shadow Behemoth in the game? Like, they talk about Shadow Behemoth as this like fearsome big creatures, but yeah. then they are in the game. Like, why? That's yeah. my main problem.
Hey, but Elder God Wars, right? Maybe.
Right. Maybe.
I mean, you never know, right? That could be a thing, I assume. Elder God Wars.
I guess just like, because I feel like in game the battle is kind of underwhelming in terms of scale, but then in the battle report they talk as if it's like this huge battle going on that's like tearing yeah. everything apart. But then in game you just see a bunch of people wearing mage armor but using melee and fighting this more recolored Abyssal Demon. So that just feel like, what?
That's true, because when you think about it, like, think of how World Event 1 felt. Like, that felt like a battle. Like, that yep. was a big chunk of the game where, you know, it felt like that was a battlefield. And this kind of feels, you know, I don't know if it's meant to feel the same, but maybe if that could have been done, maybe that would have taken care of the clutter. Aspect.
Yeah, but
taking out all them trees anyway.
Right, but at the same time, you couldn't necessarily deliver that as a mini quest. I don't know. We need to have this discussion again after it's done, I think.
Yeah.
So, we'll do that. But I want to have a look at the battle report from this week, because, you know, you look at exactly everything you have going on here, and I'm not going to do a dramatic reading this week, much to the chagrin of some people. You can find the battle report linked in the show notes at update.rsbnb.com. But what you see this week in the battle report is a combination of Nex and Sarah Doman and Char all fighting together, these people of different allegiances and forces, but their soldiers are not able to carry on much further. Everyone is getting tired. The battle has gone on for weeks, they say, and it's become a war of attrition, essentially. And their fix, what we did bringing the Takhar over, aside from getting to control those three Takhar in the tower defense portion of the game, the Takhar use their powers and open up a chasm in the ground and use that as a way to destroy the enemy forces opposing underfoot. And when the Takhar looks to be vanquished and dead, it reconstitutes itself and pulls itself up outside of that fissure. So it shows just how versatile the Takhar are in this and what their powers are able to do in the Battle of the Monolith. And also, of course, with this, you know, we see that Nex said that she's heard of the Takhar, only in Legends, of course, but of course the World Guardian knows much more. Also heard of them in the Azenandra's intelligence reports as well, and everybody, including Sarah Doman, was gobsmacked at what the Takhar were able to pull off. Unbelievable, Sarah Doman exclaimed, floating down to join them. The World Guardian managed it. And this is that battle, what you were talking about, Rib, about the battle against the Shadow Behemoth. And if not for the Takar, our forces wouldn't have been able to take out that Shadow Behemoth. Because Nex and Ceridoman weren't able to get it done, but the Takar coming in were indeed able to help. And that's what we take away from the battle report here, just how powerful the Takar are and how they are underestimated. Or I guess not underestimated, they're just not fully understood by the likes of Nex and Ceridoman. So this was a really good battle report, I feel. And, you know, if you like what's been happening in game, definitely give this week's battle report a read. And Tanis, you said it enhanced the story for you. Rib, was it enhancing the story for you this week, or was this the week that it amped itself up even more?
Yeah, I definitely like the battle reports. I feel like they're really cool, and the Togars are so badass in the battle report. I feel like they just come out and save the day.
Yeah, I mean, going back, we've looked at them on only a few quests, and it was a long time ago. I'm betting we're going to be getting a Takar quest after this is all said and done, because that's likely what the Archaeology and Slayer combos are working up towards on that. And overall, I really enjoyed this week's battle report. But
got a new dig site, obsidian-based artifacts.
There you go again. I mean, of course we'd love a new dig site. And do you really think, I don't think they'd be hiding another dig site on us without kind of, or maybe without teasing it, but I don't know.
They did mention Elder God Wars would have skillers involved, right?
So yes, maybe. It did. And maybe there will be an Elder God Wars dig site. I don't know. It's hard to say, really. But, I mean, archaeology is one way you could do it. I could see maybe augmenting other skills like Herblore and crafting. They haven't really touched – well, they took Herblore to 120, but I think combat Herblore ties in. But crafting could kind of lean into that. But nonetheless, plenty of options going forward, I think.
Well, think about this, Shane. If you got a brand new shiny car that it just rolled off the line, do you want to put some crappy 1980s like brawl on it on the front? You know, remember those leather like just crappy things you put on?
Yeah,
they put on cars in the '80s. Like, would you do that? Like, no. You're gonna tie it in with the brand new shit from this year. Like, I don't think they would do that, because there's nothing for them to... Yeah, they took Herblore to 120, but everything that they've added to it potion-wise, it doesn't really have a tie-in. Crafting hasn't been touched. So the only thing that looks modern and acts modern and people really like is archaeology.
You really think there's going to be another dig site associated with this?
Probably not, but I think it's a compelling argument.
All right, what do you think, Rip? You think we could be stealthily getting another dig site?
Not necessarily as a dig site, but I do think archaeology will get involved, or get some update, at least from these other God War things.
Right, maybe another skilling offhand.
Yep.
That could be a way.
That sounds really cool. Yep.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good idea. Neat. All right. So one thing that caught my eye, and you wrote this a while back, this document, about the Codex, and this was before Battle of the Monolith started, and you managed to piece this together and effectively nail what was going on with this. And looking back, we have this thing that was presented to us when archaeology launched. It was called the Monolith. We found out that it was the Codex when Raksha was revealed, and it was indeed an Elder artifact. And many people had assumed that going up to Raksha's release after archaeology, because if you look at the side of the monolith, it has one of Wen's symbols on it, one of the Elder gods. And following from this, there's just so much that can be asked about what the Codex is and what it does. And you've put together this very compelling theory, and I'm going to ask you questions and we're going to move through this here. But this is a discussion that says that perhaps the Codex is more than it seems. And we have to first define a few things. So one thing that many people were not aware of too much before the Raksha launch was something called Erebus. Do you want to tell the listeners what Erebus is and perhaps what it was thought to be before the recent revelations?
Yeah, I think Erebus only became a thing when Raksha became released. I don't think it was mentioned before, right?
I think it was mentioned in one line of The World Wakes.
Oh, really? Wow, I wasn't aware of that.
I don't remember exactly what they said, but I'll see if I can find that reference. I'm fairly certain we did hear about it at some point before.
Oh, really? Interesting. I think I really thought Erebus was first mentioned by Raksha.
Okay, it was first mentioned by Raksha. All right, fair enough.
Yeah, sure. But yeah, it was in like one of his special talks, like, I will drag you into Erebus, like that. And like, yeah, but then it was mentioned as Nazareth's quest. He thought it was a afterlife for Zarosians. He mentioned like, when Zarosians die, they pass to a place they call Erebus. Like, he doesn't know anything about that place. He just sense like Zarosians souls pass to a place and they call it Erebus. But then, in recent weeks, in the Battle of Monolith, Zaros himself revealed that Erebus is a place like, it's kind of like a universe, an alternative universe, or I don't know how to put it, but like a universe separate from the universe of Galenor, and that's like kind of the shadow universe.
There's your mirror universe theory, Tanis.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, continue.
Yeah, but that's basically Erebus.
Okay.
Another interesting thing to note is that like Islarion and Daz mentioned they don't know anything about Zarosian afterlife. So yeah, that's basically what we know about Erebus at this point.
Yeah, and it's supposed to be a Zarosian afterlife. So the question that first comes up is why was Zaros so interested in heading into Erebus through the monolith? And maybe we need to lay out a few different ground rules first before we get to that point. Does that work better for you than just jumping straight to that?
Come on, either way.
Okay, well, let's move through it then as you've laid it out. You also talk about why the monolith could have been considered a codex, or the codex, rather. And typically in-game, when you have a codex, it's a book of knowledge that unlocks an ability. So why is the monolith in this case considered a codex?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think my theory kind of got like half debunked by what Zara said in recent weeks. I first saw like the codex is kind of like a storage of power. So you can like, because that's how the monolith works for us, right?
With our relic powers.
Yeah, so we can put relic in it and then extract the power of that relic to us. So I thought it might work like that for Elder Gods too. So they created lots of different worlds, right? So lots of them are imperfect, but I think they learned something creating each world. So they like extract some parts of that world and put it into the codex so they can extract the power that to help them create new worlds. But then Zaro said in recent weeks that the codex was not actually designed as a codex. It was a thing to seal the Shadow Breach. So that's kind of interesting, because that kind of raises the question of why is a codex again? Because
So you're saying that it was said by Zaros recently that the Codex wasn't designed as an information repository. It was designed to effectively seal off the Shadow Realm, the Shadow Breach.
Yes. So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because, you know, one thing that happened with the archaeology launch, in addition to us getting the relic powers in-game, to the content creators, a number of them, they sent out a sculpture of the monolith that soon became the Codex. And inside of that Codex that we got and is currently sitting on my desk, amongst other things, was actually a USB thumb drive. So if the Codex was a piece of information storage, that would make perfect sense with how that was kind of tied together.
Wow. That's a really cool USB drive. I want to see it.
Well, it was just – it was effectively the container for the USB drive. But I'll show you a picture later of the actual piece of art itself. But that's beside the point here. So how did we get to this point? You talked about the Codex effectively sealing off the Shadow Breach. But where? How did we get to that, and where did the Codex come from?
Well, it was created by Ven. Zara said it was created by Ven to... Zara said Elder Gods, but it's clearly associated with Ven for the symbols on it. But it was created to like seal the Shadow Breach. In my theory, I actually had to reverse. Because in my theory, I thought the Ven created a Codex to store knowledge. But then that knowledge storage become corrupted and then become like a Shadow Breach. But what Zara said was actually the other way around.
Interesting. And I don't suppose we know how it became the Shadow Breach and this portal between the Shadow Realm and our world. I don't suppose we know that.
No, I don't think we know that. He just said like there were two breaches, but we don't know how they came to be.
Interesting. And I think the question that everybody has to ask is when Shadow comes around, and you know, we saw this in Elite Dungeon 3 with the Shadow Hands. Anything to do with the Ambassador or Zautak with this?
Yeah.
What's your theory on that?
Well, I think like there are all kinds of effort for the Shadow to break through. Right? Maybe the Ambassador was trying to create a new Shadow Breach, I think. Maybe, but we definitely stopped that.
That would make sense, I think, based on what we heard during that fight. And so just to recap then, when created the Codex, but you're saying it was first created as a way of sealing the Shadow Breach.
Yeah, that's what Dara said, at least.
And then afterwards it became an information...
A Codex.
Information repository, so to speak.
Yeah. That's really interesting, too, because how? Like, why? Why make something so dangerous a repository of knowledge? And how does this store knowledge, anyway?
And following from that, we, of course... you tell me if I'm jumping too far ahead. One thing that we saw happen in the archaeology pre-launch was Guildmaster Tony gets sucked into it. We know that Raksha became exactly what it is by coming into contact with the Codex. So how do we square all this?
So you kind of jump ahead in my theory here. So basically,
back to whatever makes sense. Then, sorry, I was jumping ahead.
Yeah, no problem. So yeah, I was thinking in my theory, like because as Nadra mentioned, Erebus is the Zarosian afterlife, right? So I was kind of thinking like, how did it fit into this scheme of the Codex being a portal to Erebus? So I feel like my theory is kind of like because we've seen with the followers of other gods, right? So when they die, they go to an afterlife based on the belief based on their belief in their lives. So I was thinking like, what if, because Zarus is the god of fate and control, right? So what if Zarus, the believers of Zarus, when they die, based on their belief, they just go to wherever Zarus wants? So instead of like going to a proper afterlife, they just go to wherever Zarus wants them to go because they believe that their fate, their whole being is being controlled by Zarus.
And that's the Shadow Realm.
Yeah. So I was thinking like Zarus sent his followers when they die, send them to Erebus so they can study the realm.
Study the knowledge that's there.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. We have to assume that with Zarus being non-corporeal, that he's seen what's happened in the future or where we're at right now. So he would have been sending all these people, these Zarosian followers, back to the Shadow Realm to do information gathering. Right. And then they're having that breach now.
Okay, I was just going to say, like, the relation between Shadow Realm and Erebus is currently not very clear. Like, we don't know if Erebus is just Shadow Realm or plays in the Shadow Realm.
Okay,
that's
a good point. We should clarify that. And we don't have information on that currently, I don't think.
Yeah.
If you had to guess, would you say that Erebus is all of the Shadow Realm or Erebus is a small part of the Shadow Realm?
I was thinking Erebus is it's not the Shadow Realm. Erebus is like a place separate, like beyond the current universe. And then because there are two shadow breaches, right? This shadow leaked out from these small breaches and then created a Shadow Realm in the current universe. That's what I was thinking.
All right, that makes sense. Tanis, you have any questions so far?
No. Am I clear? Mm-hmm. That's mud. Yep.
All right. Fair enough. And following from that, this whole discussion of Zarus, Erebus, Shadow Realm, where do we go next from this with the idea that Zarus is potentially sending these people off to Erebus through his own control?
Yeah, I was thinking, in my theory, I was thinking because my theory is based on the idea that the Codex was first created as a Codex, right? So in my original theory, I was thinking you send the followers to Erebus to study like the Codex and how to read them. But then now I actually think maybe he's been sending spies to Erebus. Like just to get to know in general, like what is going on there. Like, if there's any ruler there, if he can sabotage those rulers, if he can appease those rulers. So that's what I'm thinking right now.
Interesting. Very interesting. And, I wonder... I hope this isn't a red herring, because I feel like when we were looking at the Dragonkin... Mm-hmm. After Desperate Measures, I feel like we were getting ready to go all in on the Dragonkin bandwagon.
Same.
I'm wondering if we're reading too much into this whole Erebus business right now.
Possibly. Yeah, the Dragonkin haven't played a lot of roles after Desperate Measures.
So I'm thinking, okay, we got these breaches now with the shadow creatures popping up in the Battle of the Monolith. Is the Shadow Realm going to continue to be an issue after Battle of the Monolith is my question. Or are we going to be on to something else?
I think it would definitely will play a part because Zarus is there and like they're going to bring Zarus back. Like there's no way Zarus just go there and like disappear forever.
Yeah.
So
right.
I feel like it would definitely play a part, a big part.
And following from that, I wonder how much of what he's doing there is going to come back and bite us in our main world, right? Because he disappeared last week, and nobody knows if or when he's going to be back.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think he just, you know, off and up away, off and run away with, you know, one of the... most important people in RuneScape lore, so I don't know if you do that. But
I had a funny thought, like a jokes, half joke theory, like Zarus will come back as a boss in Elder God Wars Dungeon, and because he got Zaltak visited what he did to Crano, the ambassador. So he will become a boss. And then he will yell, "Make me an elder god!" We're fighting him.
Yeah, and we got to remember that's the whole point of everything that he wants to do with this.
Yeah.
So so then we have the Raksha area, which we talked about at the launch of Raksha, with him interacting, or the dinosaur interacting with the Codex coming out corrupted. And then you mentioned that Karapak discovered Shadow Anima through Raksha.
Yep, I think that's like a plausible point, right? Because how else would he have discovered Shadow Anima? Karapak definitely did a lot of experiments on Raksha, right? As we've seen in the lore book for Orson Dixite.
Right. Yeah, and that's something I think that many people didn't realize is that that discussion about Raksha at one of those dig sites was actually in the notes before Raksha launched, talking about Orthyn. So,
yep.
Let's see. Where do we go next?
Do you want to just follow along, like the last part of my series?
Yeah, let's follow along. Yep. So this is point six then, because we already talked about sending his followers there, right?
Yeah. So I think basically the last part is kind of like just before archaeology launch. So Zephos, which is like a member of the Inquisitor or like the city, they just manipulated Tony into becoming Zephos' librarian. So they gave Tony the Black Zone and then used the Black Zone to lure Tony inside. In my theory, I thought Zephos was trying to like, because in my theory, like the codex, the inside of the codex is locked, right? So he wanted to see if like an artifact associated with the Shadow Anima can grant him access. And I'm actually not very sure why he did that to Tony now. Maybe he just wanted to confirm if it's really a portal to Erebus, but that seems like a shady way to do it.
Well, I think Tony would have been on the cusp of discovering what was actually really going on. And if I had to guess, that's why he sent him away.
True.
Because, you know, I think Tony perhaps knew everything that we now know, of course, as an archaeology guildmaster. And recall that Tony had gone through pretty much all the mysteries except the writing on the walls mysteries. Following 99 in archaeology and guildmaster. So it's safe to think that Tony knew something was up and Zaros would have been aware of that. So that's probably why he sent him away.
Ooh, that's fair.
All right. And then following from that, you mentioned that Zaros has located the records that he wants, but finds out that the codex is locked. After studying the archive, they found it, but it's locked by Shadow Anima because the Shadow Realm seals those secrets for itself.
Yeah, that's kind of like outdated, like before Zaros clarified what the Codex is, because I thought like the Codex is a repository of knowledge, right? So before that, I thought like this, after Shadow Realm corrupted the records, the Shadow Realm kind of locked it for itself, and Zaros wanted to go in and retrieve those records. But now it's like now that Zaros revealed that like the Codex is just a portal to, it's just a breach, I think this part is kind of outdated.
Like, yeah, but still, it's an important part to lay out in terms of understanding exactly where we're at with this. Mm-hmm. But we don't know what those records are, and perhaps Zaros went there to try and access them himself.
Yeah, but maybe that said, like, he just wanted to go there to like appease the ruler of Erebus, whoever that is. Maybe Zaltak, maybe like Who knows?
Yeah, everybody loves talking about Zautag. I personally don't think it would be him, but I enjoy that every time he comes up.
Who do you think it will be?
I don't know who it will be, but I just enjoy seeing the community always point towards Zautag whenever something weird goes on. That's all.
I mean, the Shadow Reef, like the Elite Dungeons, kind of hinted Zautag is associated with the shadows and stuff. So now we're talking about Shadow Anima. They're both shadow, so I think they will be related. That's what I think right now, at least.
Yeah, and then you also have a bit that says that Zaphos at the Archaeology Guild, who was only exclusively in the pre-launch archaeology materials, which I think it was a mistake to not bring him back at some point.
Yeah, I know, right?
Theorized that Shadow Anima might be key to unlock some of the records with the Codex. Why do you think he thinks that?
Because Erebus is associated with this Shadow Anima, right? So it's only natural if you bring a piece of Shadow Anima to Erebus, then something will happen. Maybe it will be better for you. I think, like, for even after Zaphos revealed what the Codex actually did, he said, like, you require protection to enter Erebus. So he did need Shadow Anima, and he did steal Rakshas Battery, I think, to be his protection in Erebus. So, yeah. Basically because, like, they are both associated with...
Where did he steal the battery pack? I'm not remembering that.
In Rakshas pod. Like, it's in the mini quest.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
He wanted there. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right, fair
so
enough.
So he basically stole the battery and, like, okay, World Guardian, you can clean up my mess now. I'm just leaving.
Bye-bye, bye-bye, bye-bye. And, you know, of course, following from that, the events of Ezanodra's quest happens.
Yep.
And then we wind up where we're at now with the attack on the monolith and the codex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your theory and a good summary of where we're at. And I like that it's a good theory because it weaves everything all together that we know, makes some lore theory hypotheses, but it's not too far out there. So that's the thing that I took away from this, is that, okay, this is a good theory about what the general reasoning behind Zaphos was and the general state of play with Shadow Anima up to now has been, that this is something worth talking about as we head forward into the final week of Battle of the Monolith. So
yep.
I appreciate this. Is there anything else you'd like to say about your theory at all?
Well, I'm not a Zaphos fan, so I might offend some people who like Zaphos, but I think in my theory I overestimated how smart Zaphos is. I think Zaphos is actually a lot dumber because he just kind of, I try to appease the Elder Gods. They don't want me, so I'm going to appease another set of Elder Gods, and maybe they will want me. So, yeah.
And, you know, I honestly think the Elder Gods probably are not pleased with what he's doing. But at the same time, they're just interacting with the corporeal, or he's just interacting with the corporeal world they set up. And at some point, they know that that world is going to end and things are going to start over. So it really doesn't probably matter to them that much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could be very close to that with the release of the Shadow Anima, because they said, remember, any discharges of Shadow Anima near the eggs or a god dying or ascending could potentially cause the eggs to hatch.
Mm-hmm.
And dun-dun-dun, we'll see what happens next week. So,
the worst was yet to come.
The worst is yet to come.
Yeah, to come.
Tannis, any questions on this fun theory here?
No, I mean, I think it's fun to think about, and I guess we'll find out in one week?
A few days.
A few days, yeah.
Yeah, because it unlocks on Sunday, believe it or not. Sunday night, our time, reset Monday.
So. Okay.
Ooh, okay. We do have this document linked in the show notes at update.rsvme.com. Thank you, OneRib, for putting that together. And we do still have some other RS news to talk about. Before moving on to our listener question and picks of the week. But before we do that, I'd just like to thank our Patreon supporters for this week of the podcast for making everything we do here at RSBNB Update so possible and so fun to do. This week I'd like to thank Andrew C., Arvids L., Brock H., Cameron, CGB900, Christian S., Chunk the Monk, Cook Me Plocks, Danny C., Diana, Drama Free, Dream Delayed, Duramax, Jade Gizmo, Jason, Keski, Lucky Ducky, Nate the Great, Nora, Parnassius, Rastafa, Ricky A., Samuel F.L., Scott D.S., Soupfinder, Stubby Eve, The Bears O.P., The Naked Captain, The Lion, Tom V., and Zant. Thank you all of you for your support. It truly does mean the world to us. And if you're interested in learning more about what this is about, just check us out at patreon.com/RSBNB. There we offer three tiers of support. If you want to support the podcast for as little as a dollar a month, you gain access to the entire back catalog of monthly bits. We just put out a brand new one about the rise and the fall of the Java client. Recorded that this week with Zant and Earth. We were having some connection issues in terms of getting that out, but I am so glad that we waited and went with the panel we had planned. That monthly bit turned out so nice, didn't it, Tennis?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. It was. For $3 a month, you get a special VIP rank on Discord, a mention on the podcast at the start of the month, and access to high-quality stereo versions of the podcast, in addition to everything else. And for $5 a month, you'll receive a shout-out each and every week, and you'll also gain exclusive access to the clips that we used to make the clip show at the end of the year, so you can wait. You don't have to wait anymore for those clips, those pre-show clips that everybody loves to hear at patreon.com/RSBNB. Currently working towards a Patreon special thank you Patreon mail-out. When we reach the $200 tier, we'll have that and something else that we're working on behind the scenes. But, you know, what everybody's waiting for is if you, for some reason, elevate us to the $500 a month mark, Tannis and I will subject our taste buds to a wide range of spice with the Hot Ones Challenge. You're looking forward to that, aren't you?
Yep. I'm going to subject my taste buds to spice and my arm probably to an EpiPen. But here we go.
Oh, boy. You might want to do that one outside.
Right.
If the weather allows.
Uh-huh.
But if this all sounds amusing to you, check us out at patreon.com/RSBNB. Thanks so much, everyone. Okay, so after the podcast went to press last week, we had a new revelation that there's something called the Marketplace on the way. Arrived on Monday. They put this out on a Friday afternoon, and for those unaware, you typically release news on a Friday afternoon that you don't want to have covered. I don't know if that was the case with this, but the new Marketplace is going to be the place where you go and pick up anything that you'll be able to buy with rune coins, oddments, and bonds. And you'll also be able to purchase bonds directly from this interface on mobile. And, you know, we've been aiming to have this for quite a long time, haven't we?
Yeah,
a unified storefront like this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, we're not at the point yet where we're at a single currency, where you can use rune coins, oddments, or bonds to purchase something. We're not at that point yet. And when it comes down to it, what do you think of the UI of what you saw here?
I think it's really cool. Like, I've been wanting this for a long time. I always thought like it's really clunky. You have all these different stores. You have to exit the game to go to Solomon's.
Yeah.
And
granted, the Solomon stuff is not in here yet, but that's something they'll be doing in the future.
Yep.
I
think it's definitely catered towards mobile players.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we do have some new cosmetics associated with this, including the Tiztok Ak Lizard, which, you know, given the fact that we're potentially working with the Tzar recently, it kind of makes sense that they put out a Tzar-themed legendary pet, right?
Right.
That other thing looks pretty neat. It's a lizard with a fire tail. I wish I had that one, but you only need one legendary pet, right, Tanis?
Well, you only need one, but I have three.
Okay, fair enough.
Wait, that's a legendary pet?
Yeah, it is. The Tiztok Ak Lizard is a legendary pet. For 974 rune coins. Yeah. Yeah. There's also the Courier outfit, which I own. I don't know where I own that one from.
That was free.
Oh, it was free?
Installments. Yeah.
Okay. We also have the Tundra Explorer outfit. This one actually looks really nice as well. Perfect for looking good in cold environments. I want that one. We also have Saber, which is another follower pet, not a legendary pet. And the Cunning Thief's outfit. Should it be Thieves or Thieves?
Maybe we should ask Thieves.
Maybe we should. And this one can also be recolored as well. Laletia Garb, elven-themed outfit that goes hand-in-hand with what we have on Yak Track right now.
Yeah, I really like this one. I wish it was on Yak Track. But...
Yeah. And Pearl, the unicorn pet, which, I mean, everybody who wants a unicorn can have a unicorn follower now. 195 GP for this one. You also have access directly to the Oddments store and a new UI to purchase from the Oddments store as well. Bonds, you can redeem or convert bonds directly here for everything from Yak Track packages to the Auras, display name trade, or display name change. And then the shop tab is currently blank, which I assume will be going live next week with the mobile UI. But, you know, this was long needed, honestly, to get all the SGS. All I need to do now is get all the SGS stuff in there and, you know, start adding more cosmetics. Because I don't know, maybe it's just me, but at least, you know, two or three of the things that are on this thing that right now I'm actually really interested in. So.
Yeah, me too.
And I really don't say that much for cosmetics in RS. So that's saying something.
Yep, me too. And, well, even the Yak Track, I mean, my main motivation this time is the cosmetics.
Right.
Like I
but
want
it, it's also themed with your character, half the elf, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you can claim that courier outfit on Solomon's General Store for free currently. That was newly released. I wonder, can you still purchase stuff via the web UI here? I'm just on the web UI currently for this.
Solomon or Marketplace?
You can
purchase from Solomon, too.
Yeah, the thing is, I'm not seeing the lizard pet on the web
version of
Solomon's.
They are not in Solomon.
Okay.
Only in the marketplace.
Neat. All right. Time to get all that stuff, other Solomon stuff directly into there. But, you know, people will say microtransactions, and we can have that debate any day of the week, I think. But
I still think people complain too much about microtransactions, but.
Right. Because, I mean, they could be locking out portions of the game that you wouldn't have access to. They could be doing that.
I always
that.
Say, like, if you're complaining about microtransaction in RuneScape, you never play any gacha games.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously this week on Treasure Hunter, we've gone back to the combination of Smoldering versus Supernova promo. Mm. We haven't seen much of those promos where you can actually physically build your own promo set that we saw last year. So I'm wondering how that went monetarily. on that. But, I mean, overall, let's try and get some fun cosmetics in there, especially with the new character rework, and see what happens, and see how our characters can look. So,
Escape is the end game.
It should be. And, I mean, if that would be a way to send more money to Jagex and just have characters look good, I am all for that. So, I'm very pleased with that. All right, but, you know, it wouldn't be RSBNB update without patch notes. And we do have a few of those this week that we're going to have a look at right now. And starting off, some changes and fixes with Yak to the Light. A typo has been fixed for the Blade of Saildor. An issue has been fixed where the individual Saren crystal armor pieces were showing twice in the wardrobe and the dark crystal pieces weren't being showed at all.
What?
Yeah, you don't want to get to the end of Yak Track and not be able to access your goodies. When starting Yak to the Light, your progress through Yak to Basics is now correctly displayed. All right, I didn't notice that was an issue. And previously, when players tried to purchase the Premier Pass or Yak Track skips from the Yak to the Light interface, they were given a message, "This package is unavailable." That has now been fixed. On the mobile client, the mobile controls interface has been updated to use new icons. And the Black Hole experience section of the Gower quest has been improved. And the puzzle can now be solved by searching for the correct place with the required item in your backpack. And this removes the need to use an object from the backpack on a place that is obscured by the UI. Mm-hmm. Boy, that's a mouthful.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many other hidden little things like this there are in the quest, in quests.
What?
Probably a lot. If you talk about being something that the UI is obscuring or screwing up. Yeah, probably a lot.
And I mean, Gower Quest is one of the few replayable quests out there. It's just a question of, you know, how many people are doing it and how many people are going to be doing these new quests on mobile, and are there going to be any other little surprises? So hopefully there's not too many too big. Go ahead.
No.
All right, we're good then. On the achievement interface, if the prerequisites for an achievement are not met, but the achievement is complete, for example, by boosting stat prerequisites, the achievement will display as complete instead of locked. That's a bit of an odd one. If you boosted to get an achievement, yet you completed it, it would say it was locked.
Yeah, actually, when they updated it, I boosted my platinum or crafting for Damienheim achievement. And then it was saying locked for a long time.
Oh, wow. So it's been there for a long time. Okay.
Yep.
Good. That's been fixed. Action bars will now update correctly when clearing slots or switching between them. I've heard many people complain about that, and that is a big issue for PVMers, so that is good. And another big one for clue hunters, the empty tile now appears correctly on the slider puzzle boxes. I haven't done a puzzle box in so long, but that would be a pretty big pain.
I was doing, it was only there for a week, fortunately.
Oh, okay.
I was doing it for Yacht Truck, and it was so painful.
For quick prayers and curses, fixed an issue that prevents the selected highlight from disappearing when deselecting a quick prayer. Pulse scores fixed an issue that prevented the X graphic from disappearing when deselecting a skill. And this is an interesting one. The endurance mode prerequisite for the Sunshade achievement now correctly shows 25 floors, where previously it was 14. And that's a big one, because somebody's using this UI and they say, oh, I only need to get through 14 floors, but here at the end of it,
right,
it's actually 25, almost double the length. That's no fun. And, you know, I honestly don't find Dominion Tower that fun at all myself under normal circumstances.
No.
That's the reason I haven't completed the desert achievements yet. So
I mean, I like it, but I agree. It can be a grind.
Yeah.
Because you need to complete so many achievements.
The Red Cerberus armor tokens that are displayed on the Cerberus Rush info on Treasure Hunter will now correctly show the red token variant when hovered on. The achievement 61 Shades of Red is now marked as complete once the Daemonheim Slayer log has been completed, and this will also unlock the Blood Rager title. I did not know that title existed. It's not one that I see regular, but something to me sounds appealing about the Blood Rager 10 of 79.
Blood Rager. Yeah, right.
Or 10 of 79, the Blood Rager. You got to get that one if you have it.
I might have to pick that up.
Yeah, have you done the Daemonheim Slayer log?
No, I guess I haven't.
Okay. You can no longer wear a Gobi mask and an underwater disguise at the same time.
Wait, whoa. I want to know what that looks like now.
I don't know.
That's crazy.
You will now receive coins after using alchemy when borrowed power is set to high alchemy, and the alchemist amulet is in the backpack.
That's weird.
Yeah, and, you know, it's another one of those obscure ones, because I don't think borrowed power is used that often.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Elves in the Arendor Passage now take damage from bladed dive and also respond with an attack. Good. Mm-hmm. Grizzly bear death animations have been fixed. A wall near Varrock Palace now has the correct collision. Fun fact about this one, you could use this to hide yourself inside the wall. Granted, it wasn't in a PvP area, so it was more cosmetic than anything, but it was a fun little thing to do if you're coming back from a farming run. And resolved an issue with legacy interface mode that was causing the additional action bar to be hidden if the chat was also hidden.
Interesting.
And the final patch note of the week is another big one for PvMers, because Blackstone arrows are no longer consumed while using abilities on a target that is already at maximum debuff. And the reason for this is you're not getting any special effect out of them anymore. So, I mean, you could continue to waste the arrows, but why waste the arrow if you're already at maximum debuff? And apparently this is more of a problem with things like the Saren God Bow, and that's the application it's used for at the very, very high end.
Yep. So
that's the patch notes.
I think Blackstone arrows will now be cheaper. They're already pretty cheap, though.
Yeah.
If you're running ED3, you already make so little money from Blackstone arrows.
Yeah, and I've never really heard of them being used that much, because everybody, of course, loves their crossbows.
Yep.
So, all right. Let's move on. We're almost wrapped, but we do have a question this week from Dennis, who wants to know, what is your opinion on drip-fed or delayed lore releases like the Effigy Incubator being released on a monthly schedule and then the Battle of the Monolith being spread out over 4 to 5 weeks? And if you're not familiar with the term of drip-feeding, it's something that is familiar to GTA 5. It's basically the process of having content that's already for release. It's been written, coded, and animated, and so on and so forth in the game files, but its release is spread over a certain time frame to keep players' attention on the game and retain them. So I think we're about a week away from knowing if this method works with RS, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking now, Tanis? I know we were very skeptical going in.
Well, I mean, I'm still I'm skeptical on the game side of things. I don't feel like what we had in game, you know, especially on a lore perspective, is enough in the snippets. If you put it all together, it might make a medium style quest or maybe a small quest. that's without the battle reports, right? You add battle reports, now you have a whole different, now you're dealing with a whole different dynamic. But I don't think this is what RuneScape players are used to. And I don't really think, I don't know if it suits the way the quests have always been done in this game so far.
Yeah, and like I said,
to me it's more fetch style, right? To split it into little, and that's just not the style.
That's
that
not
we
our
have
ass.
Here.
That's not our ass. And like I said, if you're going to be releasing, you know, a blockbuster quest, you definitely should not split that up.
Yep.
But at the same time, maybe there's an argument to be made to have, you know, one of these kind of updates every month or every other month. Well, not every month, every other month. Especially with the mobile audience coming in.
I feel like I was when FG Incubator released, I had like a lot of problems with the way like they only released lore like every month and it's busy like getting behind it a whole year. I feel like that's like too much overkill. And like people compare to like player own ports because they also had like lore gated behind like time gates, right?
Yeah.
But I think that's completely different because for player own lore, it's actually like a sense of progression. Like you get to update your upgrade your sheep, upgrade your crew, like and unlock new areas and stuff. But for FPG Incubator and for Battle Mollus to an extent too, it's just like the same thing. Like do it 12 times each month or each week. So I feel like that's I like player own sports because there's actually this sense of progression, but the FG Incubator and Battle of Mullins are just kind of like do the same thing again and again, but except it's gated behind a time gate. So I don't really like time gating for the sake of time gating.
Yeah, and you know, I think if it is building and building each week, that's fine. But honestly, in terms of lore building, in terms of making a point, I feel like we only hit the true start of the ramp up on Battle of the Monolith this week.
Yeah. Also, like Battle of Lumbridge and the Bird and Beast, the post war events were like each week had new content added to them. There's also like a sense of progression, right? But it's just different this time because there's not really much new each week. Like each week is mostly just the same thing.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing is that it just doesn't feel RuneScape. I think that's the best way to summarize it, is that you can make something like this work, as happened with the two world events, like you mentioned. It's obviously working with the FG Incubator because people are still doing that month by month to get that lore. And people are taking part week by week for Battle of the Monolith, but it just doesn't feel RuneScape-y. And I think the point where we start having problems with this is if one of the headlining updates, say an Elder God Wars quest, like a quest proper, not a mini quest, was split into multiple pieces. I think that's where we'd start to have problems with this. But aside from that, I think as long as we keep it just tangible in terms of RuneScape, then we're fine.
I agree.
And that's the thing. And that's what anybody working on this game, anybody building this game needs to remember, is that at the end of the day, you're not dealing with a World of Warcraft or an EVE Online or any other game. This is something that has its own unique identity and has had its unique identity for 20 years. And if you stray away from that, then you're not doing RuneScape, you're doing something else. You have to put your own spin on whatever's happening, and that's where we found success before with things like the Yak Track, for example, or even the double XP weekends, or even the live events that we had. You know, people didn't like the currency events, but they were definitely a very unique spin on updates that got people to log in.
I mean, there wasn't anything wrong with them. It was that they overdid them.
Exactly.
Too many in a short amount of time.
Yeah. I agree. I also don't like how, I think for DC Cry, right, there's the Seven Spirit Hunt, and one of them is like, one of them leads you to Remington, and the clue is like, it's a town plagued by slimes. I was like, what? That's Remington? Like,
yeah, because there was really the...
How do you know Remington?
Yeah, that's because for last year's Valentine's Day quest, it was the slime quest. So
yeah, also, it was also a talking event before that, right?
Yeah.
If I remember. Yeah.
So, but summing this up, you know, as long as we maintain the essence of RuneScape, it's fine. I think for these kind of live events, you can do this, but don't start doing that for mainstay content.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Dennis, for that question. And if anybody else wants to send any in, you can just email them to questions@rsbnb.com or leave them at update.rsbnb.com/ask. And we're going to move on right now to our picks of the week. And, you know, second week of June always comes around. WWDC, otherwise known as Apple's Worldwide Developers Conference. We get a sneak peek at the upcoming versions of iOS, macOS, and any other new sorts of things that Apple might be wanting to do. And this time they unveiled iOS 15, macOS Monterey, iPadOS 15, and a number of interesting ideas around their cloud services. I'll talk about the cloud one on their own. But one thing that really jumped out at me with iOS 15 is that if you now take your photos, iOS 15 will be able to describe to you what's in that photo. They'll also be able to allow you to search for those certain keywords in your photos. And it does this all on device. Previously, you used to have to upload them to something like Google Photos. If you, the example given, you always take a trip to the zoo and you search for penguins, you're going to get penguins showing up in your photo library. But you can actually do that now in iOS, in the Photos app, and any photo you take will have it described, and if there's text on it, you'll be able to copy that text and paste it into a text document if you wanted to, or have it read over that text for you. And, Tanis, I can't imagine what this does for accessibility for you, to be able to take a picture of something and have it describe it for you.
Yeah, no, this is another huge accessibility update for Apple. Apple leads the way. You know, I work for a company that provides digital glasses, and we have, you know, six different coaches on our team, and we all use Apple. Every single one of us, and we're all visually impaired.
And I got another reason really for you to buy for you to potentially move to an M1 based Macintosh. Okay. The M1 based Macintoshes will also be able to do this.
Oh, really?
So if you upload a photo to it and put it in your photos library on an M1 based Macintosh, it will do the exact same thing.
Wow. Yeah, you know, it seems like it was. It's been a little while now, but I've noticed this when in Safari, it can do this, but it's never done it in your own photos and
exactly.
Stuff. And those are actually really small. They're a lot harder to see, right? So, yeah, this is going to be great.
Another fun thing that you'll be able to do with the combined macOS, iOS ecosystem is that if you have an iPad and you have it on your desk next to your Mac, or you have another Mac like an Air and a desktop, you'll be able to use one mouse and keyboard and move that mouse directly over to the iPad and start typing in on that iPad.
Wow.
Wow, that's really cool.
And previously, you used to have to set up complicated software to do this. It was called Synergy. It did it over the local network, but this does it all wirelessly. And you'll also be able to use any Macintosh with the new version of macOS as a bigger screen for your iPad or your iPhone. So you'll be able to, in a sense, mirror your iPhone screen to a Mac if that's how you have your setup. So imagine playing RuneScape Mobile on your phone, but mirroring that to a laptop or a desktop computer. You'll be able to do that.
That sounds really cool.
But another,
I do that with, pipe that in my classes and do that that way on mobile.
Nice. Another thing that they're doing is they're bringing out their own two-factor authenticator. You know, we all use Google Authenticator, and that's fine and whatnot. But any iCloud account now that is paid, and I could go on about the new features for iPadOS and macOS Monterey, but these are the big ones. But any paid iCloud account from their 99-cent one a month all the way up to the $10 per month one will now be called iCloud Plus. And what this does is it has new features that's called Hide My Email. It will, in effect, create a temporary email. If you need to just register to a website quickly, it'll create a temporary email so the website in question doesn't get your real email and you don't get spammed. But, and I don't know how this works from the security standpoint and the, you know, the uber technical side of it yet, but Apple is also bringing out a feature that will, in effect, work as your own VPN if you have iCloud Plus.
What?
It's called Private Relay. What it does is that whenever you're browsing with Safari on one of your devices, if you have this and you want to turn it on, it will make it sure that all traffic that leaves your device is first encrypted. And following from that, it's sent through two internet relays. So you don't want to use this if you're gaming, but if you're just wanting to browse very securely and anonymously, the first one assigns you an anonymous IP address that maps that IP address to your region, but not your actual location, because IP addresses can actually find your location down to a few blocks in some cases based on how Wi-Fi surveying has been done. But the second relay decrypts the web address that you want to visit, say google.com, and forwards you to that destination. And what they say this does, and I'm not sure how it works yet behind the scenes in the nuts and bolts, but what they say this does is it protects privacy because no one in the middle or on the other end of the connection can identify both who the user is and what sites you're visiting.
You know what's
so this
funny,
is similar to a VPN. I don't know if it works that way, but if you buy an iCloud account that is, you know, a paid account, you will have access to this.
Well, that's great, because, you know, this is kind of funny, but just got a 12 today, or just ordered a 12 today.
There you go.
I'm finally I'm finally doing it. I think it's time. I gotta let the 8 go.
I'm waiting to see what we have till the fall, but nonetheless, I think those are the biggest stories to come out of the developer conference this year. Nothing really else, you know, jumped out and broke the glass ceiling, so to speak. It was in large part a incremental year, but I think those were the big things. So that's the pick of the week, is the announcements of iOS 15 and Monterey and the entire changes to the entire Apple ecosystem with this. So that's my pick of the week.
Nice.
Rib, you're next.
Right. So my pick is a book called Blockchain Chicken Farm. It's a book about, as the title says, technologies in rural China. I'm from China, so this book is the one I've been reading a lot recently. It's a really accessible book. I first read it in like just a one afternoon, but then I kind of went back like once or twice. I think it's a really cool book because it talks about a topic that I haven't found any other books talk about. It's that's because like this author, the author of this book is Chinese, but she's from the U.S., but then she has family in China. So she kind of like walks between this line between like the perspective of from the Western world and perspective from like China. So I think that's a perspective I relate to a lot because I'm from China and I live in Canada now. So yeah, this perspective, I just really like how she provides such a perspective that shows us how, like, China, there's a lot in China that Western media isn't talking about, and there are also a lot that the Chinese living in China are not questioning, especially since this book focused on, like, technology, about how, like, Western technology is being imported into China, especially rural China.
Because I was going, like, to ask about the link of the title, Blockchain Chicken Farm.
Yeah, that's it. That's the title is basically shows that, oh, it's like this really, like, avant-garde technology is being imported into rural China to do something, like, that's kind of baffling to the Western mind, I guess, because it's used to farm chickens. But then if you put it in perspective of, like, China, there's a huge, in China, like, food security, and, like, it's a huge issue. So they use blockchain technology to track, like, chicken from the farm to, like, your table. But then the author questions, like, who is making this blockchain technology? Like, why aren't these farmers that are using this technology, like, at for example, a developer conference, like, why aren't they consulted, even though, like, they are using this technology? And is this technology actually useful for them, actually helping them, if they're just imported from the West into China? So I just really like the perspective, like, she provides about how, like, technology gets circulated between these worlds and who are making the decision, like, and who are developing what, who are they really benefiting, and whether, like, there's any problematic aspect of about that. So yeah, I just really like this book. I think, like, everyone who read it, it's something like, since I began living in Canada, like, 3 years ago, it's something like I always wanted to tell others, but, like, I don't know how to articulate. And when I read this book, I was like, damn, this is, everyone should read this book. This is what I've been trying to say, you know?
Yeah, and you know, one thing I find with technology too is that to truly have the discussion on everything that is both a positive and negative of technology, to truly unlock its potential, you have to have that discussion. But you also have to have open standards, which is what blockchain is and what a lot of open source software enables people to do.
That's like a huge point she's making. Like, blockchain is supposed to be open, but then the people making blockchain technology are all, like, white males. Like, these farmers in China who are using this are not, they are not at the conference that making them. They are not, like, the technology is not designed to them. Like, who are making this technology, even though it's supposed to be open.
Yeah, and see, that's the whole thing. And that's the beautiful thing about open source software, is that if you have an open source library or an open source piece of software, it can be adapted to whatever you want from, you know, something like you see at Apple's developer conference, or, you know, in the case of blockchain, obviously the chicken farm, as we see here in this. So I think that's a good pick of the week.
Yeah, but then I think what they're saying is, like, even though they are supposedly open source, like, the conventions for writing them, like, how to read them, how to write them, are not decided by everyone. They're decided by, like, a very privileged group in the Western world.
Yeah, you need to have that kind of
point she's making. So, like, she's like, we need to reflect a lot about, like, imperialist relationships between countries, and how they are, like, treating each other. But yeah, I don't know how to articulate it. As I said, just go read this book; it's amazing.
Yeah, I put a link to Amazon in the show notes at update.rspnb.com.
Yep.
All right, Tanis, you're up.
I got a photo for us this week, Shane.
All right.
140 million light years away, worlds are colliding. Actually, galaxies, to be more exact. They are merging, and we have some just incredible photos from NASA that they put up on their Instagram.
This is real world universe sandbox.
It really is. And one, I was at first I thought it was funny. I'm like, wow, here's this story, and yet they felt compelled to, you know, tell us how many likes it got on Instagram. But then I was like, actually, cool. If you're on Instagram, follow NASA, because you can see these pictures and just, it just puts things in perspective of how small we are, what a speck we are, you know? Like, yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. I know one thing we had as pick of the week many, 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 many moons ago was APOD Astronomy Photo of the Day. I know that website still keeps going, so that's another one that comes up too. So, yeah.
Nice.
So many of these fun things like this come up, and you know, you have to realize that these events that are happening, granted we just get the photo now, but 130 million light years translates to the fact that 130 million years ago is what we saw happening. So thank you for the picture.
Yep.
All right, let's do some achievements. I believe you got the first batch, Rib.
Yep. So yeah, Sigma Gamma got 99 prayer on June 9th, 2021. And then on June 8th, 2021, a lot of people got so many achievements. Eric got 120 invention. Hong Deers got 99 smithing. Masgram got 99 agility. Search Aurora got 99. Oh, wait, Masgram got 99 fire making. Sorry. Search Aurora got 99 agility. And then WM Penguin got a whole bunch of 99s for mining, hunter, divination, and woodcutting. So congratulations.
Nicely done. Next up on the 7th, we have Zero Gary with 120 magic, Eryx with 99 archaeology, Miss Alaska got 120 magic, Turd Sniffer Zero got 99 summoning, and then on the 6th, we have Easel with 120 magic, Holy Nicholas with Holy Nicholas with 99 magic, Ultra Dog 177 with 99 archaeology, and WM Penguin with 99 thieving, and Tannis is the last bunch.
All right. Then we have Shanty You Stay with 99 prayer on June 4th. And then Up the Irons 05 got 99 runecrafting, invention, crafting, and construction all on June 4th. Then we have Love Natural with 120 farming on June 3rd. Looky there, Shane.
Nice.
We also have Twisted Soul with 99 prayer on the 3rd, and Zardones with 99 prayer on the 3rd.
Well done, everyone. Well done. Well done all across the board. And, you know, time to talk about what we've been up to. And for me, that is exclusively, at this point, Yak Track. And, you know, I want to have a bit of a conversation about one of the Yak Track tasks, or how things have changed, because we didn't talk about this last week, but runecrafting tasks used to be make X number of rune. But they have since changed that to base XP in the runecrafting skill.
Oh, skip.
Oh.
Yeah. So at task 20, that was 167k runecrafting XP, which was about 600 soul runes. That took the better part of an hour and a half.
Yep. The ironic thing is the other task is skill and kill, right?
The other task was construction.
Oh, all right. I was thinking about a different one.
There's a later one that is runecrafting or skill and kill, but you'll definitely do skill and kill first.
For that one, I tried to do runecrafting, but then I completed skill and kill first.
There you go.
That's ridiculous.
And the boosts from the Abyss and Demonic Skull do not count. If that was the case, you'd only need to do two loads of soul runes instead of the four and a bit that you have to do with this. And if you didn't have access to the rune span, you'd be looking at something around 18,000 nature runes for this first test 20.
That feels like we're going backwards.
Or about an hour and a bit at runespan, right?
Yeah.
Like there, this one you either have to do runespan or soul runes, because you're dealing with tens of thousands of runes in the other case, which is just bonkers.
Yeah, well, in RuneSpan, I mean, you're going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, now skip this one.
Or do construction contracts, which I wish I would have done.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't mind construction contracts. I mean, it wouldn't
be so
bad.
That was the option for number 20. Later on, you're better off to just skill and kill. So
okay, well, that's not quite so bad then.
I wish we still had the rune task, honestly. Make X amount of runes.
Same. I agree. 100%.
But that's what I've been up to, and like I said last week, I needed the Yak-Trak. I'm currently on task 26. So, been having good fun with that. How about you, Tanis? What have you been up to on RS?
I've been Yak-Tracking too, except for the hours that I spent down at the battle. Did about 2 hours of that this week. But yeah, pretty much just doing Yak-Trak, and I've enjoyed, like, I'm not as far along as you have been, but, you know, I'm still, every other one is a skill and kill. And
right, and then every other three past 30 and so on and so forth. So it's nice that they have those sprinkled in.
Yeah, and and even when you don't have them, I've been getting, you know, thieving or archaeology, stuff that I don't mind doing anyway.
So. Yeah. My archaeology tasks are looking for potion recipes and collecting soil for the inevitable screen soil tasks. But how about you, Rib? What do you do to keep yourself busy on RS?
Yeah, mostly Yak-Trak too, and just like Reaper tasks.
Okay.
Elite dungeons, yeah.
Reaper Elite Dungeons, so that kind of PVM stuff. That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. I actually did Reaper tasks at the end of combat week, and I actually enjoyed doing Reaper tasks more than I enjoyed doing Slayer until it assigned me Raksha, that was.
Yeah, I think PVM is a lot of fun. Like, more people should try it.
Yeah, and, you know, we can have discussions on how to get people to try it and whatnot. So I think that's something they need to work on. So, but nonetheless, sounds pretty good. I don't think there's anything else we have left to do on this episode. So thank you for joining us, everybody. Thank you to you, One Rib, for also being here and sharing that theory with us. I saw that. I read that document. I thought, oh, I have to have him on the show at some point before Battle of the Monolith is done. And I'm glad we did.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Of course, of course. And you can subscribe to update on any podcast listener out there. We're on Apple, Google, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, YouTube. You can find us at youtube.com/RSBNB. Give us a like and subscribe there. It'll help the channel out. And we'll be back next week. See you then, everyone. Take care.
See ya.
Yeah.